Determined, a memoir, written by Martin Baranek, narrated by J.W. Major. Preface, Lisa B. Cicero. This is the story of the Miracle Kid, the nickname given to Martin Baranek by his concentration camp brethren. I'm standing beside Martin in the town square of his former hometown of Bierbsnik, Poland. A taxi driver approaches and begins speaking to Martin in Polish. I can hear the anguish in the man's voice as he says to Martin, "I remember October 27, 1942. I was too young to do anything. I was just a child." He asks Martin what has become of his former classmates and neighbors. Martin tells him of the few who survived the war, but mostly of those who did not. The man has a helpless expression frozen in time on his aging face. Martin is a regular participant in the March of the Living, an annual pilgrimage to Auschwitz-Birkenau on Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day. The purpose of the march is to educate students and adults, Jewish and non-Jewish alike, about the horrors of the Holocaust. Martin retells his life story while standing in the barracks in Birkenau. I convince him that his story must be memorialized for future generations, and he agrees to meet with me to document his experiences. He talks about life in Poland and his struggle to recuperate in the war's aftermath. We travel together to Poland, Austria, and Israel on three separate occasions, visiting his hometown and the camps where he was a prisoner. Martin's story is compelling because he experiences a ghetto, a labor camp, a concentration camp, and a death camp. By the age of 15, he also experiences a death march, and finally, liberation. Martin Baranek is the embodiment of the 20th century Eastern European Jewish experience. Many wonder how and why one person survives the Holocaust while another does not, and whether place of birth or other circumstances play a part. Is it fate? Luck? Destiny? The answer is unknowable. For Martin, it may be his insuppressible spirit, or perhaps a series of miracles linked together that allowed him, one of the few from his family, to survive. For the dead and the living, we must bear witness. Elie Wiesel. Introduction. Martin Baranek. God tested me. Like Job, he put stumbling blocks before me. And even though I survived, I no longer believe in God. How can I believe in a God who took my little brother, and 1.5 million other children, children whose only crime was that they were born Jewish? How can I believe in a God when I was beaten, starved, and tormented without justification? I witnessed death and was surrounded by death. I cheated death not once, but at least twice. Fear was my constant companion, like a shadow that followed me, but it did not extinguish, even in the dark. I live each moment despite the fear. I fear not what awaits me after this life, for I have survived indescribable misery and torment. Hell is living with the memory of what I have seen. Perhaps when it is my time, the movie reel that plays again and again in my mind will finally pause, and I will be able to sleep in peace. Perhaps heaven is having no memory of pain. I am a Holocaust survivor, but physical survival is only one aspect of living through this tragedy. I lost everything: my childhood, my family, my dignity, my possessions, my security, and my belief in God. I was driven to make something of my life, to overcome obstacles, to learn new languages, to adapt to new cultures, and to create a new family. I did not want to remain forever in the camps, psychologically, never to return to normalcy. No one survived the Holocaust normal. After liberation, many organizations helped feed, clothe, and house us, but there were scarce resources to help survivors overcome tremendous emotional trauma, the torment of deprivation, and dehumanizing abuse and slavery. My generation was unlikely to seek out psychological counseling or admit that post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, is real. Survivors coped the best they could, some better than others. Few can say they are tested and know the depths of what they are made of and what they can endure. Few can say that stripped of everything, they know their true essence, their true identity. Holocaust survivors know these things. I know these things. After the war, I kept busy and moved forward with my life, not speaking about my past. Still, every night, the movie reel played in my head. I still see the images, hear the screams, feel the pain as I attempt to sleep. I internalized much of my suffering, but I learned that one cannot outrun trauma. It has a way of manifesting itself and cannot be erased. Each year at the Passover Seder, Jews around the world read the Haggadah, the Jewish text that recounts the history of the Hebrew slaves in Egypt and their liberation from Pharaoh. During the service, we read that each of us is obliged to see ourselves as if we were personally freed from slavery, as if we, too, went forth from Egypt. For Holocaust survivors, this is something real. I don't have to imagine it. Survivors walk in the shoes of the Israelites who transformed themselves from slaves of the Egyptian Pharaoh to wanderers in the desert before finally entering into the Promised Land. Upon our liberation from the Nazi pharaohs, Holocaust survivors wandered in displaced person camps, DP camps, before arriving, mostly illegally, in far-flung places around the globe. Many, including me, arrived in Palestine, our biblical homeland, the future state of Israel. Many of my survivor friends never wanted to return to Europe after the war because it was a place of terrible memories and extreme loss. It remains the largest Jewish cemetery on earth, a cemetery without individual graves or headstones. But Alex Haley's roots inspired me to return. In 1978, my wife Betty and I traveled to Poland for the first time since the war. I did not mention the trip to my many survivor friends. Why go back? My friends would have asked. I had many reasons to revisit, to walk the streets of my childhood, to see the buildings and home of my past, to smell the flowers that adorned the gardens of my youth. I still struggle to make sense of it all, and I wanted desperately to feel close to the ones I once loved, but I've since lost. I wanted to honor and pay tribute to those dear to me who perished, and also to show respect to those who perished whom I never knew. I felt an overwhelming need to retrace my steps, to remind myself that I did, in fact, survive. Returning serves as a reminder that nations, indeed entire civilizations, can, through open and dedicated involvement, or through passive inaction, be led down a path of evil. I do not fault anyone for failing to aid Jewish families at their own peril, but I will not forgive those who overtly took action to turn in Jews, to betray them, to commit atrocities. For as long as I am able, I will make the pilgrimage each spring to remember and to bear witness. I believe it is a mitzvah, a good deed, to participate in the March of the Living. There is no better way to educate people than hearing survivor stories firsthand. Some survivors believe it is a sin to return to Poland, but I see it as an opportunity to teach what humans are capable of doing to their fellow human beings. It is important for people to hear it from someone with personal experience, not just to read about it in books, but to stand at the places where evil occurred and to try to ensure that genocide of any kind and in any manner does not happen again. Christopher Browning, a history professor at the University of North Carolina, who has written a number of books on the Holocaust, wanted to investigate the survival of Jews from the region of Poland known as Wierzbnik Starohubice, where I was born and lived during my early youth. He contacted me for an interview for his book, published in 2010, called Remembering Survival, Inside a Nazi Slave Labor Camp. The premise of the book aside from Browning's theory of why a disproportionate number of Jews from Wirbsnik survived, is that individuals may remember the same events differently. According to Browning, a number of middle-class Jews with means procured work permits and were thus protected in a factory where their skills were necessary for the war effort. Wirbsnik Jews with work permits were not relocated far from their homes and were able to access hidden money and valuables to sell or trade on the black market, and could make deals with factory guards or non-Jewish contacts outside the camp. Wirbsnik Jews were accustomed to a camp environment when the factories were eventually evacuated, and they were transported to concentration camps and death camps toward the latter part of the war. Many survivors suffer in silence. Some details are just too painful or humiliating to impart to another human being. I have watched survivors break down in an attempt to just say out loud what happened to them, as if vocalizing it could create a physical wound. It is a burden to carry these heavy emotions and overwhelming memories. The world will never fully know all the atrocities the Nazi collaborators inflicted upon their victims. As much as what I share is terrible, there are occurrences far worse than what I am able to articulate. These will remain forever within me, in a deep and hidden place. To what do I attribute my survival? Was it Beshert? Meant to be? Or perhaps divine intervention? I have come to ascribe my survival to a series of large and small phenomena I call miracles. Monsters exist, but they are too few in number to be truly dangerous. More dangerous are the common men, the functionaries ready to believe and to act without asking questions. Primo Levi. Early years, my childhood in the small town of Wirbsnik in the Starachowice region, Poland. The Germans have invaded Poland. They are bombing Wirbsnik. Quickly, now, gather a few things. We will go to the countryside for a few days until things settle down. The coach is waiting for us downstairs. My father's tone was calm, but suggested an urgency that he rarely revealed. We had been following the news from Germany, of course, and how things were deteriorating there, especially for the Jews. But we were relatively far away from the chaos of Germany. We were in southern Poland, in the little town of Wirbsnik. I had always felt safe in our quaint town, insulated. Don't all 9-year-olds feel unassailable? Or perhaps my parents had sheltered us from big grown-up issues. I was raised with a sense of continuity. Generations of Jews, including my family, had lived and died in Poland, and I assumed as much for myself. Wirbsnik, located in the Starachowice region, was founded in 1624 as a mining and metallurgical settlement. Until the early 1800s, the area was inhabited by the Cistercian monks of Wohotsk, who built a blast furnace in 1789. The Starzechowski family owned a forge built near the Kamienna River, a tributary of the Vistula River. As the population increased, weekly markets and annual fairs expanded. In the 1800s, the area continued to serve as a center of metallurgy, with iron foundries, ore mines, and a smelting furnace. The area was surrounded by dense forests and rolling hills, so lumber yards, sawmills, and a plywood factory were built in the vicinity. The late 1800s also saw the construction of a railway line, linking the town to larger cities. Life in Eastern Europe, where there has always been an undercurrent of anti-Semitism, has never been easy for Jews. The local population became wary of the growing Jewish population. Perhaps the majority felt threatened by the Jews' ingenuity, tenacity, and success, or perhaps their fears were just age-old xenophobia. The Jewish population was different, spoke a peculiar language, ate unfamiliar food, kept unknown traditions, such that in 1862, a decree was issued denying Jews the right to reside in Wirbsnik Starachowice proper. Despite these early acts of anti-Semitism, the thriving Jewish community played an important role in the development of local industry and found success in business, education, and other professions. There were doctors and dentists, veterinarians and pharmacists, as well as a community of Jewish traders, peddlers, and skilled, prosperous workers. There were cattle dealers and tailors, leather workers and shoemakers, upholsterers and hat makers, watchmakers and photographers, carpenters, kosher butchers, bakers, bankers, printers, and blacksmiths. There were companies specializing in textiles and construction, along with brickyards, transporters, beer houses, and a distillery, all a testament to a burgeoning community that maintained a reasonable expectation for a bright future. An address book from 1930 lists my grandfather, Haskell, as a tinsmith.